decided to take one's own life. These extreme examples of fanaticism are probably not something you, the reader, are experiencing in your own life, but an attachment at this level has other manifestations that are not so easily recognized. Loved ones can do their best to try to wake someone from this illusion, but as with anything, the individual must have an authentic desire to change their mind. But that doesn't mean the loved ones should stop trying. A will or desire to live is the catalyst for that change of mind. Once that desire is found, and respect for one's humanity is regained, an individual can begin to move down the levels of attachment. At this point, the illusion can begin to fade. This is true for both the aggressor and the victim. We cannot give what we don't have. Letting go of this attachment starts by respecting our own life. There is still a lot of work to be done to let go of the illusion, the corrupted version of knowledge that no longer reflects life, but what our attachment wants to see. As we find that grounding desire, we begin to see a sliver of truth that acts as a foundation for our transformation. Though we still work to let go of illusion, we have found a moment of clarity. A truth, in the form of life, was chosen. In regaining respect for our own humanity, and the humanity of others, we begin to become aware of the strength of our own will. Chapter 10. The Biggest Demon. My father has always pushed me to question my knowledge, challenge my attachments, and discover new ways of understanding. And so, during my training, he would often present me with puzzles. One day he asked, "Miguel, do you know what the biggest demon in the world is?" I thought for a moment, then shook my head no. "It's love," he replied with a slight smile playing on his lips. "How can love be the biggest demon in the world?" I responded doubtfully, feeling my emotional reaction coursing through my body, its epicenter somewhere around my belly. I felt the irritation of a child who knows his father is about to burst another one of his favorite bubbles. "Solve the puzzle and you will find out," he said. I looked at my father, the man who had written the book The Mastery of Love, in disbelief. "Love can't be the biggest demon in the world," I practically shouted. "We are all love. We all share love. Love is all we are." To this he simply replied, "Miguel, figure it out." And he walked away. I thought about this, but it made absolutely no sense to me. We are love. We are born into love. How could he even say that love is a demon? And allegedly the biggest demon of all. And if I am love, how can I be the biggest demon in the world? The puzzle sat unsolved in my mind for quite some time. Then came my moment of clarity, the kind that arrives out of the blue and sets you on the path that guides you through the rest of your life. It arrived while I was watching the San Diego Chargers play against the Oakland Raiders, two football teams that share a big rivalry. I am well aware of my level of attachment to the Chargers. When I watch them play, I make a conscious choice to engage in the game, and I quickly go to a level 3 attachment. Sometimes I even go to a level 4. This is probably why my epiphany came during a football game. In the first quarter of this particular game, the television suddenly went silent. Something was wrong with the television or the transmission, and the game had no sound at all. I couldn't hear what was going on. Sensing an opportunity, I decided to assign myself an exercise. I challenged myself to watch the game as if I had never watched football before. My goal was to unlearn or let go of what I knew about football and simply enjoy the scene in front of me. I wanted to detach from all of my preconceptions. It took me quite a while to stop describing to myself what was happening on the field and just watch the game unfold. I saw two teams in battle and began to understand their plays and actions from a fresh perspective. I began to see each action as if it were truth unfolding. My mind went silent, and I simply watched. A deeper connection formed between me and what was happening on the field at that moment. I was enthused by the play of both teams. Somewhere around halftime, the sound returned, and lo and behold, there were now two voices describing what was happening, narrating every moment. The narrators were telling me where to place my focus, and I could feel my attention being steered until I was no longer watching the game unfold as I had before, but instead was listening to what I was being told. The narrators informed me when to cheer and when not to cheer. They explained why the ball was thrown, why a touchdown was possible, and why the defense was doing so well. Then they started describing things that weren't even happening on the field. Why a player held out on his contract, who should be traded, which player didn't deserve to even be on the team. I began to pay attention to only what the voices wanted me to see as they excitedly pointed out stunning plays and judgmentally expressed disapproval of weak players. When the game ended, I could only recall what those sportscasters wanted me to remember. Only glimpses of truth. A touchdown, a great tackle, or an amazing pass shone through all that narration. Then the post-game show started, and every moment of the game was recounted. I apparently needed a team of narrators to tell me what I had just seen. That's when I had my sudden realization. I have those same commentators in my own head. The only difference is that they have my own voice. Just like taking a sip of wine and thinking about the region and varietal of the grapes instead of enjoying the experience, I let the narrators talk about whatever catches my attention, and it is usually something I'm already attached to. This pulls me away from my experience of the present moment, the way a rubber band stretched too far snaps backward. The narrators are the voices of the filter of what we know, the thoughts and beliefs that construct our belief system. This is what my father referred to as the voice of knowledge. I simply call them the narrators. In the Toltec tradition, there is a symbol we use to describe all the chatter in our mind, the mitote, which means a thousand voices all talking at the same time. Those voices are all trying to catch your attention, and the ones that speak the loudest are usually the ones that manifest in the form of an attachment. Some narrators may speak from distortion, while others may speak from truth. Through our reason, we are able to tell the difference between the two, but it is difficult for us to tell them apart if we are attached to them. Depending on which narrators we are attached to, we will perceive the world through their narration, thus creating our world in their image. Of course, I had always understood this on an intellectual level, but through this experience, I finally understood it on a much deeper, intuitive level. These narrators are the personification of our attachments to things, ideas, and beliefs. They can keep us rooted to past experiences as we try to make sense of the present. We have a predilection for fitting new experiences neatly into our preconceptions of life. These voices also keep us focused on some idealistic goal for ourselves, something to attain in the future, or something we might even convince ourselves we will never attain, but think we should still strive for. Turning our attention back to love, our narrators also play a major role in our relationships. In my own case, when I was younger, I fell in love with a beautiful young lady. But after some time of just enjoying our love for each other, we grew comfortable and fell into a routine. At this point, we began to find some faults with the relationship and started to argue over what should be in order for our relationship to meet our expectations. Other than what she told me, I had no idea what was really going on in her mind. However, I knew what was going on in mine. My narrators were commentating, "To be the perfect girlfriend, she should be like this. Our love is supposed to be this way. She does this to control me. How can I make her happy? I should do this." All the things my narrators told me were based on my attachment to what I believed a relationship should be in order for us to continue loving each other. All these expectations were informed by my past experience and the beliefs I had acquired growing up. I allowed my knowledge to analyze how a relationship is supposed to be, and I believed it. I was no longer connecting or having a communion with my beloved. My attention was on the voice of my narrators. At the time, I could see that while our love was still there, our attachment to the ideas about what we thought love should be would ultimately come between us. This was all a product of listening to our narrators. And so, through this football game insight and the reflection of my relationship, I finally understood what my father meant when he said that love is the biggest demon. Instead of simply experiencing love being love, narrators explain how love should feel, what makes us worthy of love, who should love us, and how they should express it, what we need to do or achieve to love ourselves, and what others need to do in order to receive our love in return. We begin to believe the narrator's analysis of what love should be and become attached to that belief. We begin to impose it on ourselves and others, thus creating a distorted reflection of love. Narrators convince us that if we can achieve an imagined perfection, we will be so full of love that life will be smooth going from then on. But what has really happened is we have made love conditional. And if we continue to follow the guidance of our narrators, we will go from childhood to young adulthood and beyond attached to the idea that we need to find a living personification of what true love is. In order to be in love, we must have someone to love. And, of course, that person is supposed to love us back. We get really hung up on this part, forming our idea of love through positive and negative reinforcement, much the way we do as children, always seeking our parents' approval, yearning for their acceptance and shrinking from their disapproval. This kind of love has so many conditions attached that suffering is inevitable. And in this way, love becomes the biggest demon of all. Our distortions turn the angel of unconditional love into the demon, a symbol of the distortion of the truth, exaggerating our fears and distorting our view even more, creating a personal hell for ourselves. When we look in the mirror and do not see a reflection of love, it means we can't see through the smoke that distorts our view and makes us think that love is something that needs to be gained, like the elusive carrot on a stick. If we look at our reflection and into our eyes, we will see what lies beyond them. We will see the truth. There is no need to chase love when we are love. We simply release our attachment to what we expect to see so that we can see beyond it. We turn off the volume on our narrators, the voice of our knowledge, and simply engage the present, and the true image of love will appear. We have always been love, but we have grown so accustomed to the smoky, distorted reflection of love that doesn't allow us to see or accept ourselves that we don't know how to live life without it, which is the biggest lie. But when we become aware of our attachment and decide to let go of the distortion, then the motivation to change comes from our own love, and it gives us a whole new perspective on life. This genuine motivation is the subject of the next section. When we let go of our attachment to our narrators, specifically their judgments and criticisms, and accept ourselves as we are, conditional love will no longer be the motivator that compels us to change. For example, if I look in the mirror and say, "Hey, Michael, you are out of shape. No one will take you seriously if you look like that. You need to lose some weight." I am being motivated by the distorted opinions of my narrators. But when I look in the mirror and say, "Hey, Miguel, you are the perfect you in this moment, and I accept you completely, but I see that you might want to lose a few pounds in order to be more healthy," then I am being motivated to make changes by the desire to care for myself, which comes from self-love. Going on a diet is not a condition by which I accept myself. Rather, I recognize the truth of my unhealthy state, and I decide to make a change, not because conditional love has forced my hand, but because I love and accept myself. Taking steps to improve our health, change careers, or really do anything that will transform our lives is often an emotional process. The fear of failure or of not obtaining the goal we set out to achieve often keeps us from taking action and actually perpetuates what we do not want. In an episode of Frasier, a popular American TV show in the 1990s, Frasier is battling his past and has a hallucination of all his former love interests. He comes to a conclusion that illustrates my point very well, saying, "I am alone because I am afraid to be alone." He doesn't take a chance on love because he fears he will fail and then have to feel the discomfort of rejection. Fortunately, he realizes that the only way forward is to let go of the wounds that are holding him back. Believing that we need to avoid rejection at all costs is a very common belief. For instance, if someone says to you, "I'm not attracted to you," you have a choice about what to do with that knowledge. You can accept the truth without the narrator and realize that it has nothing to do with you and has everything to do with that person and his or her particular taste. The news is still hard to hear, but it is simple, and it ends there. Your other choice, and unfortunately this is a more common reaction, is to take that person's taste preference and use it against yourself to reinforce some negative belief you have. "That person is not attracted to me because I am overweight, I am too short, etc." In this way, you end up using someone else's taste preference to convince yourself that you are not deserving of your own love or acceptance. The motivation to make improvements suddenly becomes conditional. If I lose a few pounds, maybe she will like me better, or maybe someone even better will be attracted to me. Either way, you are making a choice. You can choose to let your self-acceptance be subjugated by another person's taste or opinion, or you can choose to accept that they have simply stated what is true for them, and that does not change who you are. In my experience, the only motivator that brings lasting change is self-love. When I love and accept myself, I want to treat myself well and be as healthy as I can be. Only then do I have the freedom to detoxify from whatever has been subjugating my will. When it comes to being motivated by self-love to make changes in life, there are no musts or shoulds. The key phrase here is, "I want to make this change for me." When you say yes to this choice, then you can begin the process. Doing it for yourself rather than to please others or to please your narrators makes all the difference between creating lasting change versus a temporary illusion. Regardless of whether you stumble along the way, when you want to make a change, you keep getting up, exercising your will like a muscle in training. As your will strengthens, you will know what passion is. Passion is the expression of love, our authentic self, in the form of our intention. A goal, an end result, is simply a focal point that allows us to conduct our intention in that direction, enjoying the whole process that brings us to that point because we are living through it. Authentic love is the greatest motivator for letting go of our attachments, while conditional love only strengthens our attachments. Knowing the difference is key as we enter the process of detaching from the conditions and agreements that keep us from experiencing our authenticity. At the root of this is how we relate to ourselves and the people in our lives. "I cannot give what I don't have." If I have conditional love, I will give conditional love. If I have authentic love, then I will be able to give authentic love. The best way to let go of illusion is choosing to accept the truth as it is presented to us, just as it is. As it has been said, the truth will set you free. Chapter 11. Moving Through the Levels of Attachment. In my experience, the majority of people I encounter in life seem to be at levels 3 and 4, identity and internalization. Although the voices of fanaticism are certainly the loudest, those at level 5 seem to represent the minority of the people with whom I have interacted in the dream of the planet. However, it is important to notice that each of us moves up and down the levels of attachment during the trajectory of our life, and so we have all experienced different levels of attachment at one time or another. We can move up and down the levels with awareness and sometimes without awareness, like a child who is hooked on an unpleasant moment until something else happens to divert or redirect their attention. Of course, as adults, our attachments are much stronger than this childlike experience, since we have a tendency to get very comfortable in our beliefs and circumstances. However, we can still change the focal point of our attention if we choose to go through the process of redirection. Redirection. We must first become aware of where our attention is in the moment. Becoming aware of our attachments is the start of any process. Recognizing which beliefs we have either become identified with, internalized, or fanaticized is the first step in moving towards our authentic self in any situation. Accepting the truth at that moment is accepting ourselves for who we are, attachments and all. From this point of acceptance, the question will be, do I want to keep the attachment? If we choose to keep it, and sometimes we will, that is fine, because we are doing so while being aware of the attachment and choosing to live life in that way. If we don't want to keep it, then we can make a choice to begin to let go. The freedom to choose between these two options is the manifestation of our intent, the power of choice. As we grow more attached to what we believe, it is much more difficult to see the power of our intent. This is especially true when we have agreements that do not allow us to detach without first judging ourselves for even thinking of changing our mind. Moving from level 5 to level 4. In levels 5 and 4, fanaticism and internalization, the dream of the planet influences the way we view ourselves and how we behave. In other words, domestication reigns above all else. Moving from the extreme point of fanaticism, the loss of humanity, to internalization requires the ability to see that our life and all life is more valuable than any idea or belief. Love and respect for self and others is the beginning to letting go of fanaticism. We cannot give what we do not have. Respect for life starts with our own, and love is the grounding source for this respect. Seeing that our life is worth something allows us to see that the life of another individual is just as special. But to let go of the most extreme form of conditional love requires an ability to question the agreements that are tied to it. The act of questioning produces a moment of clarity that allows us to see our truth. A consequence of this attachment to knowledge at the level of fanaticism is that we impose self-judgment upon ourselves for even thinking that there may be another way in the form of questioning. For example, how dare I think of any other possibility other than Toltec? I'm a traitor to the philosophy. I should burn for this treachery. When we are at level 5, it is difficult to even question our attachments. However, questioning is indeed the way to break through the grip our attachment to knowledge has upon our will. This process is a bit like being on the monkey bars. The only way to move forward is to let go of the bar that is behind us as we propel ourselves forward to reach for the next bar. If we do not let go of the previous bar, we won't be able to move forward. A moment of doubt in a belief can be the crack that will begin to expand our perception. Doubt in the form of skepticism with the willingness to learn allows us to withhold our agreement until we have clearly heard and considered everything that pertains to our belief. Skepticism makes it possible to reassess a belief and make a decision to hold on to it by saying yes or no. Remember, there is a yes at the root of every belief we have, but a no can be enough to change our beliefs. Our no is just as powerful as our yes. This is the assertion of our will, and our becoming aware of it allows us the opportunity to no longer be subjugated by our knowledge. Here, we begin to realize that we, not our knowledge, are in control. To recap, moving from level 5, fanaticism, to level 4, internalization, requires an awareness of the knowledge we perceive and then asking ourselves, do I really believe this? Why do I believe this? Does this belief serve me? Reevaluating our beliefs introduces the option to continue to believe or to change. The mere act of exercising choice allows us to once again become aware of our own will. Letting go of fanaticism is to allow ourselves to listen to what we perceive and reassess our willingness to say yes or no to it with awareness, to choose to redirect the focal point of our attention as we become more aware of the vast possibilities life is offering us. The best way to let go of illusion is to say yes to the truth when it is presented to us. Moving from level 4 to level 3. Moving from level 4, internalization, to level 3, identity, requires that we recognize our attachment to the mechanism of conditional love. Acceptance and rejection itself, our narrator's distorted commentary, is, according to Toltec tradition, the catalyst for the distortion or corruption of knowledge that allows us to internalize our identity. When we let go of that internal struggle between truth and lies, we cross over to level 3, identity. In our tradition, this rebellion represents the birth of a Toltec warrior. When we recognize that the mechanism has a hold of us, we make a choice to not believe in it, thus beginning an internal war for our own personal freedom. My father's beautiful work, The Four Agreements, and The Fifth Agreement, a collaboration between my father and my brother Don Jose, as well as the works of many other great spiritual and inspirational teachers and masters from other beautiful traditions, provide us with incredibly useful tools to help us move from level 4, internalization, to level 3, identity. For example, when we make the choice to practice the Toltec agreements, 1. Be impeccable with your word. 2. Don't take anything personally. 3. Don't make assumptions. 4. Always do your best. 5. Be skeptical, but learn to listen. We begin to let go of those agreements and conditions by which we deem ourselves unworthy of our own love and begin to see our attachments from a perspective of objectivity. We also become aware that our attachment to domestication may even tempt us to use these Toltec agreements of personal freedom or any such tools for transformation, as the conditions of self-acceptance and our acceptance of others. Thus we distort these tools from the instruments of transformation that they are intended to be, into the 5 conditions of our personal freedom. How do we keep our choice to pursue our personal freedom from becoming the conditions of our own acceptance? We apply the lessons by our own choice and remain aware that they are merely the tools we use to guide our intent as we practice the mastery of our own self-love. In other words, we begin to use knowledge as an instrument to help guide our intent with awareness. This requires a choice to accept ourselves for who we are. The moment we realize that we can love ourselves just the way we are, we can see that domestication is no longer needed. Our acceptance is no longer in the future. We are living that love at this moment. Becoming aware of our actions, taking responsibility for our own will, and repenting if need be, allow us to forgive ourselves and others for our actions and theirs, which helps us to let go of domestication. Exercise, using a labyrinth in the Toltec tradition. In my family's Toltec tradition, we practice a method of forgiveness and letting go of our domestication as well as our emotional wounds and poison by using the labyrinth, a single path maze. It is a symbol and ceremony used in various ways by many tribes and traditions of the world. The particular exercise that follows is performed in our Toltec tradition, but it is not the only way to use the labyrinth as a tool for transformation. Envision yourself at the beginning of the labyrinth. First, you must be willing to enter. If you are not ready to forgive and let go, you have a choice to not enter the labyrinth. This exercise only has power if you say yes by your own will, and by your own will alone will you be able to engage in the exercise. If you do choose to enter, this is the action of saying, "Yes, I am ready to forgive and take responsibility for my own will." As you enter the labyrinth, imagine it is a roadmap of your past that leads to your present moment in life. With every turn, envision a person, a moment, or a belief that you have used in some way to domesticate yourself. What or whom have you used to subjugate your own will in order to be accepted by yourself or others? When you hold that vision in your mind, a person, for example, stop, envision him or her, and become aware of how their words have contributed to your domestication and say, "Forgive me. I have used your words to go against myself." Although that person might have used his or her words and actions to domesticate you or to cause you harm or pain, you are the one who ultimately said yes to the belief and allowed it to blossom in your mind. Becoming aware of your responsibility for your half of a relationship is crucial as well. It's not just the other person's fault. Recognize that you have been using someone else's words or past actions to potentially cause both of you harm simply by saying yes. The action of saying yes is letting their words and actions impact you, allowing them to hurt you or go against you. Their words and actions have power to hurt you only by permission, because you chose to agree with them. Forgiveness happens the moment you say no to carrying this pain, this weight, this hurt, and let go of it all. Say aloud or to yourself, "Forgive me. I have used your words and actions against myself, and I will no longer use them to hurt myself again." Forgiveness is the action that allows us to move forward in the labyrinth. In my case, I can envision people who have judged me for the sake of domestication from their point of view. "Forgive me. I have used your words and actions against myself, and I will no longer use them this way." Of course, I can also see the people who told me the truth, especially when I was hurting myself, and I thank them for their clear reflection of my actions. Continue through the labyrinth, repeating the same action of forgiveness as new people and situations come to mind, whatever person or wound hooks your attention at that moment. That is the next one you are ready to face and to forgive. As you reach the end of a labyrinth, you may either find yourself at an exit or at a point in the very center. For the sake of this illustration, you will find yourself at the entrance to the center of the labyrinth. Stop here. Look at the entrance to the center point and envision a mirror. Walk up to that mirror and see your own reflection. When you are ready, repeat these words. "Forgive me. I have used your words most of all to go against myself, and I will no longer use them to hurt myself again." The action of entering the center point of the labyrinth represents the moment you forgive yourself. This is the action of your own forgiveness and of reclaiming the power or the impeccability of your own word, of your own intent. You are worthy of your own forgiveness as much as you are worthy of your own love. At this point in this exercise, you have let go of the past by recognizing that the only thing that exists is this present moment. The labyrinth itself is now the past, and you can let it go as you forgive yourself. With awareness, you can now draw the knowledge from your past to make choices in the present moment. The labyrinth expands as you live your life, but the only truth is in that center, that present moment where you are alive. The labyrinth ceremony ends when you recognize that you are worthy of your own love, because you are alive in this very moment. This ceremony is a living symbol. It only has power through our intent. Like the active work of applying the lessons and writings of the masters and teachers who help us heal from our wounds, the labyrinth is meant to represent the active work of letting go of illusion. Letting go of our knowledge in the form of level 4, internalization, allows us to once again reclaim our personal freedom from the tyrant of our domestication, as we move to the third level of attachment, identity. When we are no longer controlled by the distorted voices of our narrators, our identity gives our experiences significance and allows us to understand them by using our knowledge as an effective, helpful tool. Thus, our identity and our knowledge enable us to interact with the dream of the planet, with a power we do not have when we are at the level of internalization. In order for us to relate to and be a part of the dream of the planet, knowledge needs to understand us. This is the function of knowledge. It fulfills a need to understand ourselves and the world in which we live. We use it to manage our experience of life and to express our impressions of it. The philosopher René Descartes' famous proclamation, "I think, therefore I am," is the expression of this attachment to identity. But "I think, therefore I am" is uncorrupted by the mechanism of judge and victim, since it no longer has to distort knowledge to fit the attachment. It simply describes what is without distortion. The attachment to identity is the personification of knowledge as ourselves. We call ourselves a concept in an effort to make sense of our complex selves. The moment we let go of our attachment to identity is the moment we become aware of the separation of our being and what we know. Knowledge exists only because we are alive, and our will is the bridge between knowledge and ourselves in the form of our choice between yes and no. Moving from level 3 to level 2. Moving from level 3, identity, to level 2, preference, is the moment we become aware of ourselves without needing to identify ourselves. Level 3 is like having a mask you don't realize you can remove. The moment you understand that the image of the mask is not you, you regain the awareness of your true self, an individual who is completely free to take any direction in life. At the root of everything that gives form to our belief systems, there is a yes. That yes gives life to an idea, a symbol, or a story because it has your intent. Each person's identity has a meaning because they give it a meaning by agreeing with it. Letting go of the attachment to an identity is recognizing that there is a clear separation between you, the authentic self, and knowledge. That line is your yes and your no. It is your intention. When you recognize your truth, that you are a living being regardless of what you know, you are free to let go of the attachment of needing to know who you are, because you have the awareness that you are. When you authentically choose how you want to engage in your own life, as well as in the dream of the planet, the mask of your identity no longer has to shield your authentic self in order to have a voice. You are in control of your intention, your personal dream. The hallmarks of this level of attachment are that you love yourself unconditionally in this present moment. You play in the dream of the planet, knowing that your yes and no give life to your art, and you understand that truth exists regardless of whether or not you believe in it, while a belief only exists for as long as you believe in it. Let's revisit the imagery of the smoky mirror through our Toltec tradition. We've broken through the smoke enough to see the mirror as we let go of fanaticism. We've cleared the smoke as we let go of internalization, and we've become aware that the mirror only reflected the truth as we let go of identity. Now, as we let go of preference, we become aware of being the truth that the mirror reflects. Moving from level 2 to level 1. Preference is based on an awareness of the authentic self, the living being that is me, and the willingness to engage life. We have the awareness that the present moment can take any direction, but there is a preference for a certain direction. Regardless of that preference or the action we may take based on it, the awareness of the authentic self will endure. We can engage completely in the moment or concept. Moving from preference to the authentic self is simply the act of disengaging from our preferences as the moment passes. We can then re-engage, attach, or disengage, detach at will, when we choose to live in the moment. What is the authentic self? What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. William Shakespeare. The level of the authentic self is a name or term that simply describes the living being that has the capacity to engage life. Our authentic self is present throughout each and every level. We simply have filters that block our awareness of it. We can choose to be our authentic self as a being who is completely free from attachment, if that is what we choose to be. This state can be temporarily reached through meditation and other similar practices. I say temporarily because our awareness normally fluctuates throughout our lives as we engage the dream of the planet and are tempted by the mechanism of the judge and the victim. The authentic self is the living being that gives life to our bodies, enabling us to perceive and project life and interact with the dream of the planet. It is the energy that moves this pen across the paper until the being leaves this body. It is pure, unlimited potential. What is me, if it's not my identity or my authentic self, is the question my knowledge asks of me. Even the label we are using, the authentic self, is a symbol to express something we want to understand. Who am I? This is one of the most important questions on the spiritual path. The answer cannot be put into words, yet I know that I exist. Just as I can say, I am not this body, I can also say, I am not this mind. I am just this living being giving both my body and my mind life, an empty definition whose meaning can only be determined by my yes or no. The five levels of attachment aren't rules or guidelines for achieving level one, the authentic self. The five levels are simply a framework to help us become aware of where we are at this moment in relation to the various things in our life. We can look at any situation and determine what is driving our thoughts and behavior as far as a particular attachment is concerned. With awareness of how attached we are to a particular belief or idea, we regain something very important: our ability to make a choice, to say yes or no all over again. The true freedom we have as individuals is to be able to choose with full awareness of what we want and don't want, instead of allowing our knowledge to dictate what we are supposed to be or choose. Our freedom to choose is true freedom. It is free will. If we choose to remain attached to something that brings us pain, it is because that thing also comforts us in some way. Knowing this, we have the opportunity to further examine ourselves. If we are unaware, we go through life with blinders on, a slave to the distorted commentary of our narrators. But with awareness, we will be able to answer my grandmother's question, "Is knowledge controlling you, or are you controlling knowledge?" The answer is the truth of where I am at this moment, and the truth will set me free. When you are ready to let go of an attachment, all that is required to begin is a willingness to say, "Yes, I want to let go." And that is the simple beauty of it. From a place of awareness, we no longer require the mechanism of the judge and victim to motivate ourselves. Our new motivator is passion, stoked only by unconditional love and recognition of our limitless potential to move forward in the trajectory of our choosing. Chapter 12. Uncovering Our Stories and Assumptions. It's one thing to define and illustrate attachments in general, but it is quite another to recognize attachments in ourselves. This can be achieved by examining our beliefs and their effects on our personal dream. There is a difference between learning from our own experience in life and learning from what others tell us their experiences have been. Just like in the teachings of my family, I didn't understand until I was able to see a concept or trait in myself. It is my intention that the next section will help guide you on your personal journey of self-exploration. Exercise: Uncovering Your Assumptions. Begin drawing a circle on a piece of paper until you are about three-quarters done. Then stop. Even though you have not completed it, you can still recognize the shape as a circle. This is because the mind has the ability to make the assumption that we are looking at a circle and will complete it for us. The same is true if we draw two sides of a triangle. We see it as a triangle. Based on our past experiences, our mind has the uncanny ability to fill in the missing parts when all the information is not available. This is the Gestalt principle of closure. Our minds react to familiar patterns even though we have received incomplete information. Artists use this method when creating conceptual art, which is often quite thought-provoking and mind-boggling. But the mind doesn't just do this with geometrical shapes. It fills in gaps to make assumptions about everything. The mind shows preference when adding information, too, and favors adding what it thinks it already knows. That is, it supplements incomplete new information with the beliefs it is already attached to. As an example, let's pretend I am a man who is brokenhearted over my last relationship in which my girlfriend left me for another guy. I have a new girlfriend whom I've been dating for a few months. I am waiting for her phone call. As time passes by, I wonder, why hasn't she called? It is 7 p.m. and she should be finished with work. And then my mind attempts to answer my question. Here are some possibilities that my mind comes up with based on my past experience to complete the triangle. A. She is out with her girlfriends. B. She is at the gym working out. C. She is with another man. Although I didn't have all the information, my mind came up with three possibilities. If I am unaware of my attachment to past experience that I label as knowledge, I will gravitate to the story that best fits my narrative. She is with another man. Coming from a place of unawareness, my emotional reaction is to grab hold of this last assumption and think back to any time when she wasn't available for me. As I do so, my anger and my attachment grow, and my mind reinforces my insecurity with even more assumptions. Of course, that explains everything, I think. At that moment, the door opens and in walks my girlfriend with shopping bags full of food and goodies. Surprise, she says. I turn around in anger and shout, "You are cheating on me!" Bang! Fight! Because I was still stuck on my last failed relationship, my insecurity was dominant, and the assumption that my new girlfriend had also cheated on me best fit my storyline. Coming from a healthier place, I could have attached myself to one of the other assumptions, or no assumption at all. But my attention went to the information that fed my insecurity because it felt most familiar to me at the time. This is the problem with making assumptions. To make matters worse, we not only are predisposed to assume things, we also become attached to our assumptions and convince ourselves of their truth. They complete the missing line in the story so that we can grasp a whole truth by shining light, what we think we know based on our previous knowledge, into the darkness of the unknown. But it is a line of information that is not based in truth. It is a line that satisfies an internal need for resolution. We are willing to even distort this line so that life fits what we believe it should be based on prior experiences. If the actions we take in life are based on information we perceive, not having all the information can stop us in our tracks. Our sense of security is often dependent on knowing the big picture and taking the right actions, although we cannot possibly know everything. From that point of view, there is a need for assumptions to reinforce our sense of security. The more we are attached to a belief that offers us that sense of security, the more attached we are to the correctness of that assumption. We are only one point of perception, and cannot possibly be aware of everything. Therefore, one action experienced by many will have many stories to explain and justify it. Each person fills in their version of the story with the familiar lines of what they assume to be true based on their attachments. We are attached to creating a story about every action from our own point of view, describing, explaining, and fitting it into our own belief system. This is what we have been taught to do. Let's say I stand up from where I am sitting, walk across the room, and kiss your hand. The kiss is the truth. The missing information is, why did I do that? What does the action represent? What does it all mean? The answers to these questions are subjective and are based on what we already know and all the possibilities that are available within our belief system. Only I know for certain why I have kissed your hand. When we don't have all the information, often the first story we tell ourselves is the closest to the truth. You may say, Miguel kissed my hand to prove a point. But as we tell and retell our story about the event, we add on to the story, often coming up with less desirable possibilities, like in the example about my girlfriend not calling. Someone with distorted perception might end up convincing herself that I kissed her hand out of pity, because she is getting old. Believing an assumption is a choice, though if I am unaware that my mind is filling in gaps, then this is not really a choice at all. I am at the mercy of my assumptions. But when I have that awareness, an assumption allows me to consider a possibility that will only become true the moment, and only at that moment, when it comes to fruition. If the assumption is incorrect, with awareness I am able to simply release it, and new possibilities abound. Seeing our attachments for what they